Tendon versus anesthesia and pain association. Here it is. Mr. Lin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is John Lin. I represent the appellant in this case, Dr. Michael Brandon. Dr. Brandon was fired from his job as an anesthesiologist 8.5 years ago because he did what Illinois public policy encouraged him to do. He reported Medicare fraud by his employer, APM, and its billing practices. Since that time, he's won 2 trials in the district court and 2 appeals in this court. He now has a final judgment worth a little over $2.5 million. The question in this appeal, the third appeal, is whether Dr. Brandon can collect on that judgment. Collection's a problem here because the 5 doctors who owned or operated APM stripped the corporation of all its assets, placed them in their own pockets or in a new corporation, St. Clair, that they created, and left Dr. Brandon with an empty shell of a corporation with no way to collect on his judgment. Now, we think the district court made several legal errors in this case, and I'd like to turn first to our fraudulent transfer claims, and specifically the issue of the transfer of the almost $900,000 in accounts receivable from APM to the 5 doctors. Now, the doctors take the position that APM did not own the accounts receivable. They claim they owned the accounts receivable. Even though these were corporate assets, they were generated by the corporation, and even though it's undisputed, they did not provide any consideration.
Why shouldn't you like that position? Because if it's true, it means that we can just look through the corporation completely. And if you get the other physicians to say the corporation was an empty shell, it's never a real corporation, it's just a partnership in fact, then you can just go and collect directly from the other anesthesiologists. So why are you resisting this rather than embracing it?
Well, I think the problem that I have is on the fraudulent transfer claim. And you have to realize that the alter ego doctrine, as far as I've been able to determine, doesn't apply, or it only applies to shareholders. I couldn't find adequate authority to support the idea that it applies to non-shareholders. So we're suing the 2 doctors who are not shareholders, Dr. Gillen and Dr. Chinnapalli. And if I'm going to make a fraudulent transfer claim, it seems to me that I have to show that APM had some sort of property interest that they transferred.
You may not be understanding my question. Okay. The implication of the anesthesia, the shareholders' contention about the receivables is that this is not a corporation. It's just a partnership, that it's really their personal property all along.
Well, I mean, they're not saying
if that's true, you don't have to show any fraudulent transfer from this non-thing to them. You just collect from them directly.
All 5 doctors? That's the issue, though.
Proceed. We're not on the same wavelength.
All right. In any event, the question I wanted to address, at least for purposes of the fraudulent transfer statute, is whether the accounts receivable were assets of the corporation within the meaning of the fraudulent transfer statute. And how are assets defined under the fraudulent transfer statute? Well, they're defined pragmatically. The question isn't whether the debtor owns the asset in question. The question is whether, regardless of whether he does or doesn't own it, is it subject to the claims of creditors? That's the test. Is it something that creditors could execute on. Is it part of the pool of assets that creditors can
So you're suing... Are you suing all five of the doctors?
Correct.
So you're suing the two corporations and the five doctors. Is that right?
That's correct. Of course, APM has no significant assets. The question here, first of all, is were these accounts receivable subject to the claims of creditors, notwithstanding the doctor's claim that they owned them? And the answer is clearly yes, for two reasons.
I thought your point was simply that when you got the judgment against, APM?
Correct.
They immediately took the money out of APM, gave it to the doctors, turned APM into a shell, and then formed this new, St. Clair Anesthesia, which is just a successor and carried on as before. Right?
Correct.
Isn't that your argument?
It is. It was a series of transactions, all of which were driven by the same motive, which was to defeat Dr. Brandon's rights as a creditor. And that's why there's a fraudulent transfer claim. There's also why there are alter ego claims, which are very closely related to the fraudulent transfer claims.
Is there any reason why APMA was never thrown into bankruptcy? You were by far its major investor once this court sustained the jury verdict and should have been able to throw it into bankruptcy, and then it would have been easy to collect these things, not only as, or not even necessarily as fraudulent conveyances, but simply as preferential transfers to corporate insiders, which under the bankruptcy code always get knocked out in favor of debt holders, and your client is a debt holder. So why in the world didn't you put it in bankruptcy?
Well, first of all, the timing of these issues were such that we got a jury verdict, and immediately thereafter, this process began of collecting accounts receivable beginning the new corporation.
Yes, all the more reason for you to put it in bankruptcy immediately.
But I wasn't involved in the case at that stage of the proceedings, but I don't believe
My question is not limited to you personally,
right,
but to your client and whoever was representing the client. Did you have a reason for not putting it in bankruptcy, or did it just not occur to you?
I don't know that it occurred to us at that time. And part of the problem was this happened very quickly.
All of this stuff happened very quickly. There's a one-year look-back period in bankruptcy for transfers to insiders. So he had a year after these transfers to put it in bankruptcy. The bankruptcy is very well designed for this kind of behavior, but the theories that you're now relying on aren't necessarily very well designed for it. Well, but anyway, go ahead.
In any event, Judge, the doctors argue that they acknowledge that they didn't have any right of access to the accounts receivable while the doctors were still employed there. But what they argue is that once they resigned, then they had a right to the accounts receivable. But, our basic position is you simply can't ignore, as the doctors do, the reason why they resigned. All five of them at the same time. And the reason was so they could collect the accounts receivable so that Dr. Braddon could not execute on them. It's not as if these doctors all decided at the same time that we don't want to be doctors anymore, we want to go into another line of work, or they decided they still wanted to be doctors, but they were all going to go their separate ways. Those would be non-fraudulent reasons. The only reason they resigned altogether at one time was to defeat Dr. Brandon's right to collect on the judgment. And it's worthwhile keeping in mind that APM, or its predecessor, was in business for 30 years. And they paid creditors all the time. They paid salaries, they paid rent, and so forth. It didn't matter that the shareholders owned the accounts receivable. Creditors always got paid, except one creditor. And that was Dr. Brandon. Then all of a sudden it made a difference that the shareholders owned the accounts receivable. And why did it make a difference? Because they all decided at one time to quit and take all these accounts receivable with them. So it's no answer for the doctors to argue that they had a so-called right to the accounts receivable once they resigned. I'd like to move on to the issue of intent, where we contend the district court made another legal error. Now, what the doctors say and the district court actually found was they weren't trying to avoid Dr. Brandon's jury verdict. What they were trying to avoid was what they perceived to be the negative consequences of the jury verdict. Now, the judge accepted this argument. I think this is just wordplay. You know, it's just empty semantics.
I don't know why. Again, my question is, why are you resisting it rather than embracing it as saying QED?
Well, because Your Honor, I'm responding to the arguments the judge made.
Problem of lawyers to deny what the other side says rather than, as in cases like this, to say, thank you for proving my point.
Well, thank you for proving the point, Judge. I think there's a couple other issues regarding intent. Obviously, if you accept the judge's reasoning on this particular point, you're going to have some really perverse consequences. It essentially would allow debtors to engage in all sorts of fraudulent conduct aimed at defeating the rights of creditors, and they would be able to get away with it because all they would have to say when they were challenged was, well, we weren't avoiding the judgment. We were just avoiding the effects of the judgment. Now, what were these bad effects anyway? The main one, what the accountant called the first reason why the doctors did what they did, was simply that Dr. Brandon might execute on the accounts receivable, and they didn't want that to happen. They wanted the accounts receivable for themselves. So that's hardly a legitimate reason. What was the other consequence they were trying to avoid? Well, the doctors said they were concerned that the two non-shareholder doctors, Dr. Chinnapalli and Dr. Gillen, might quit in order to get their share of the accounts receivable. And this would lead to a whole bunch of negative consequences. But that whole argument's built on a false premise. It assumes that these doctors were on the verge of quitting, and they weren't. There's not a speck of evidence in the record that these two doctors were thinking about quitting or they said anything to anybody about quitting. In fact, Dr. Gillen testified that he did not threaten to resign. I'm not out of arguments, but I am out of time.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Lynn. Mr. Stein?
May it please the Court. My name is Kevin Stein. I'm going to be arguing in response to the position set forth related to the fraudulent conveyances and piercing the corporate veil by the appellant. Three things I want to point out to the court is that the trial court determined that the bonuses paid by APM to its doctors in November of 1999 were paid in the ordinary course of business and were already earned by the doctors. These are findings of fact. The trial court also determined that the accounts receivable were owned by the individual doctors and were purchased from APM for fair consideration. Again, another finding of fact. The court also found that APM...
Hard to take this seriously, though. I mean, it's perfectly clear what's going on here. These people want to deduct the consequences of Brandon's judgment.
As indeed they said.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's true. This system of they purchased these accounts receivable in 1970 when the corporation was started. This judgment wasn't entered until 32 years later. Fair consideration was paid.
All this would have happened even if there was no judgment against the corporation.
I don't know that
all these gyrations. If Dr. Brandon never existed.
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I'm talking about the fact that the doctors did purchase and own the accounts receivable individually. That was done in 1970 for fair consideration.
But as he said, these accounts receivable were used to pay other debts of the corporation.
That's true, and it's just like if I personally own a piece of real estate that I lease to my corporation, and maybe that lease has a 30-year term. During that 30 years, my corporation has the right to use that real estate. Because it
but
pays rent.
But this didn't have a term.
Well, it did have a term. The term was until the doctors terminated employment. When the doctors terminated
employment. They control the term. I mean, it's just trickery. Forming this new company, St. Clair. What's going on here? This is all deducting the judgment. That's perfectly clear. The judge got confused by this badges of fraud business.
Well, I don't know if the judge...
checklist...
I don't think the judge got confused when he made a factual determination that the accounts receivable were owned by the individual doctors, that had been in place for 30 years, and that Dr. Brandon, in fact, even participated in it. And now he's complaining about it.
This is a way simply of pretending to be a corporation when actually the assets are owned by individuals. The corporation has no assets. It's a shell.
Judge, I don't think that's the case. A personal services corporation does not have assets by its very nature.
Oh,
it'll
no,
have
it
desks.
Does have assets. It has things like receivables.
No, it, Judge.
And it has an exclusive services contract with a hospital, which
Judge.
Is highly valuable. Now, your position seems to be that you can arrange it so that it doesn't have even the assets of a normal personal services corporation, which may be true. But, of course, that's a normal reason for, as the hackneyed phrase is, piercing the corporate veil, because it deceives outside creditors into, you know, believing that it's a normal corporation when, in fact, it's been jimmied.
Your Honor, I don't think that just because the shareholders individually own the accounts receivable, it wasn't even the shareholders, it's the doctors, that means that they're somehow a shell corporation. There are a lot of personal services corporations that don't have accounts receivable. People pay cash when they come in. Or if they do have accounts receivable, they factor them, so they get the money up front. Would there be any difference in this case if the doctors had factored the accounts receivable, obtained money up front, and then paid that out as a bonus throughout the years instead of letting the accounts receivable accumulate, which they owned? I don't see any difference. And I don't think just because the corporation did not own its accounts receivable, that makes it a shell corporation. They followed all the corporate formalities. That's part of dealing with a personal services corporation. They don't have hard assets.
You can see what the trick is. The accounts receivable are used by the corporation to pay their ordinary debt so they can keep in business. Then when this crusher comes along, they quickly dissolve the corporation and reform it so they don't have to pay the judgment. It's perfectly transparent. I don't understand how the case has gotten this far.
No.
Why was APM allowed to continue to exist with a couple hundred dollars?
Why was it allowed to, in a corporate form?
Yeah.
Judge, my co-counsel is going to address that argument. I'm not prepared to argue that point.
Mm-hmm. You can't offer an opinion on why?
Judge, I think I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of corporations that maintain their corporate status merely by paying their fee every year that aren't actively in business. Maybe one of the reasons is so you can keep the corporate protection. Because once you dissolve, you do have personal liability.
To try to bamboozle the district judge about Illinois successorship doctrine is one possible understanding, since that's what persuaded the district court that the new corporation couldn't be a successor to the old. It was still on the books of the Illinois Secretary of State. I can't see any other reason. But, of course, that just reinforces the impression that everything that has been done for no reason. No legitimate business reason, certainly nothing you can explain, other than to stiff the plaintiff.
Well, the reason APM was ceased in business is because two non-shareholder doctors wanted to collect their accounts receivable, and they didn't have any type of duty to stick around.
Why did they want to do that all of a sudden?
Because Dr. Brandon, they thought, might get a judgment.
Right.
That's why they did.
Thank you.
Precisely.
That's why they collected them.
QED.
They didn't have any fiduciary duty to stick around. They weren't officers of the corporation. As far as the bankruptcy issue, Your Honor, I do want to address that point. I don't think that the bankruptcy would have changed anything because we would still come down to the issue of who owned the accounts receivable. If the individual doctors own them, the trustee in bankruptcy couldn't use them. So I don't think that would have changed things. I think we'd still have the same issues to deal with. It's just we'd be dealing with it in bankruptcy court. There are no other questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stein. You. Mr. Urban?
If it pleases the court, maybe I can answer your question. Your question was, why is APM still in existence? Because this man didn't make us not be in existence. I think the court was right on point. There were
exactly.
options.
Wait,
pardon?
Wait, go through that again.
Well, APM is a corporation. It is still a valid corporation. It still exists under the laws of the state of Illinois.
Why are you continuing it? Why isn't it dissolved?
No one's made us.
No, well,
no.
You every year send in a fee to the Illinois mm-hmm. Secretary of State to continue the corporation's existence.
That's correct.
Why do you do that?
We do that so that we have the protections that surround a corporation. As the court is well aware,
there's no assets. What protection? I don't understand.
Well, the reasons that bring people to courts just like this is to an attempt to insulate assets. In this situation,
it doesn't have any assets.
Well, that's just it. We did have a microwave.
It never had any assets.
The assets of a personal service corporation are basically the assets that exist in that office. It exists in the form of a typewriter and a computer and a microwave.
It doesn't have any of those anymore.
Exactly.
So why do you send in the annual fee if, in your view, what you're doing is protecting non-existent assets?
That's a good question. But the fact is, we have done that.
So we would like a straight answer.
Very well. The answer to that is, as I said earlier, no one has made us do anything to the contrary. And I'm not being flippant, Your Honor. What I'm saying is...
So you just make an annual contribution to reduce the Illinois budget deficit, and no one has made you stop. Is that your view?
That's it.
What's the benefit you derive from this payment?
In this situation, since there are no assets, there really isn't
then
much of
it. Then why do you do it? Why does your client do it?
I really don't have an answer for the court in that regards. I know that this has been something that was necessary for us to keep track of the fact that under Illinois law, when you're dealing with successor corporations, there cannot be an action against the predecessor successor corporation if the predecessor corporation is still in existence.
That I understand. But, of course, that's just the proposition that this is all part of a scam on a judgment creditor.
I don't appreciate the word scam. I think that our clients are taking steps here to address assets.
Right.
That
and
they
if those steps are lawful, then judgments aren't worth anything.
Well, Judge,
they're so easily defeated, costlessly defeated by you.
Well, Judge, I would point out that one of the things that we're dealing with here is a question as to whether these assets were part of a corporation or whether these were assets that were outside of the corporation. Mr. Stein has addressed that issue, and it's our position, obviously, that these are assets that were outside of this corporation. Now, there are two issues that pertain to St. Clair. And first of all, whether or not the mere continuation doctrine would hold them somehow responsible for the debts of APM. And the second doctrine is whether there's been a creation of St. Clair for a fraudulent purpose.
Well, I don't see how keeping APM alive can possibly affect the status of St. Clair. That's too gimmicky.
Well, it may be, Judge, but the fact is that under case law...
Why would law be so stupid as to say that for $200 you can buy your way out of the successorship doctrine? Law
well,
would have to be asinine, wouldn't it? Asinine to say that for $200 you can defeat a significant legal doctrine.
Well, the court the legislature addresses four ways that you can get at these assets. One of them is whether or not the...
But answer my question. What is the logic of... why would Illinois law say, well, if you want to pay a couple of $100 a year, you are immune from successor liability? Why would they do that?
Judge, I don't have an answer for that. The fact is...
I think they did it deliberately. They made a judgment. This was the way to go.
Well, Judge, I think that there is the ability to pierce the corporate veil. In other words, if you can show that all this is in existence, that all the people are doing is paying $200, there are tools available in our legal system to pierce the corporate veil and get to it.
Yes, precisely. Just say, well, this is a phony this is a nothing corporation, so we'll ignore it. That's the tool we're suggesting should have been used by the district court.
Well, in any event...
Do you have any reason... why that tool would not work here?
Well, I think, Judge, that the principal case on this...
Forget the principal case. Is there a reason? Something sensible. some sensible reason why this particular veil would not be pierced. You've admitted the corporation has no assets. Okay. So
that's correct.
Wouldn't that be the simplest situation for piercing the veil?
The method that that our adversaries used to try to pierce the veil, however, was to establish that this was a mere continuation of the corporation.
Which it is.
Except, Judge, that the principal case on this says that you have to have four elements to establish. I didn't create this case. I'm just quoting it. And that is that there are four elements, and one of them has to be that the prior corporation has dissolved.
It's like arguing a case in the 12th century.
Well, Judge, you bring up the issue de facto. And I would point out to the court that Illinois does not recognize the de facto dissolution of a corporation. The Illinois, and I don't mean to equate our ages, but I know that most of us were around in 1983 when the Illinois Business Corporations Act came into effect. And it was a monumental transfer of the assets or the issues dealing with corporations. Illinois legislature did not see fit to create the existence of a de facto corporation. It doesn't exist. The only case cited by my adversary is a 1907 case. The fact is Illinois does not recognize a de facto corporation, and as such, there is no de facto dissolution here at this point in time.
I don't understand that at all.
In any event, Judge, the fact is...
You can have a de facto dissolution of a non-de facto corporation, can't you?
Well, we have a valid corporation.
It's like you may not like the Middle Ages. You know, you happily argue these preposterous technicalities. You can't...
We're lawyers. We're supposed to argue
this. You can't prevent yourself from smiling at the absurdity of it. You haven't given a reason that might convince an ordinary person why your clients should get out of paying this judgment.
Well, the answer to that lies in a different area, Judge. My clients should get out of this because this is not an asset that belonged to that corporation. We're mixing apples and oranges. We're looking at
it as a corporate asset and paying all the other creditors.
No, it's not a corporate asset. This was an asset.
It treated it as a corporate asset when it paid the other creditors.
This is an asset that belonged to these people individually. They held
it up.
But
when an ordinary creditor was giving credit to APM, they were relying on these accounts receivable. They thought these were assets of the corporation.
They may have thought that, but these were not assets
of
the corporation.
They were deceived, in other words.
If they misrepresented the
corporate asset.
If there was deception, in any case or form, might have been to Illinois Power. It wouldn't have been to this particular doctor because he was part to it and he paid into it. Judge, I see that my time is very short, and I will defer to Mr. Stein for the balance. I thank the courts for their attention.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Irvin. Mr. Lynn, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Just one brief point on the mere continuation doctrine. Illinois courts have never decided the question whether it has to be dissolved in fact or dissolved in law. But what Illinois has done is said, let's be realistic about this. I mean, the whole doctrine is designed to be realistic. Look past form. Look at the substance of things. And it wouldn't make sense if that's the whole purpose of the doctrine to say, you know, this corporation is still alive. Because we all know it's not. Realistically, practically, and there's no reason to think Illinois wouldn't follow that approach. Unless the court has any other questions.
Okay, thank you, Tony. Thank you to both sides. Next case for